The Online Learning Task Force for October 19th, 2009. We have almost all of our committee members present. Senator Bonamici will soon be here. Ms. Squires, I believe, is on the telephone. We do have three members that will not be able to participate today. Kathleen Scalise, Kristen Parent, and Senator Morse. We have a very full agenda this morning. We're going to start off by doing some things that will actually probably involve some committee involvement. Not as if everything doesn't involve some committee involvement, but we thought it would be good to hear back from the work groups and obviously give the participants in the work groups a chance to actually comment on their respective reporters and if they want to add anything to those reports. To remind everyone, which probably doesn't require, but just for the sake of the audience, the reason the co-chairs created these work groups was to provide a greater opportunity to get actual discussion between the participants of this committee, because obviously this is a very large committee, and because of the way it meets, a relatively formal committee, and we thought it was very important to get people a better chance to just talk with one another. So we had three different work groups made up of pretty diverse groups in each work group, and we're going to start off with reports from each of the work groups, and I'm going to start with Representative Gelzer.
Oh, so I was moving from the middle to the beginning, not the middle to the end.
That's right, that's why I
asked. Great. Well, thank you very much. Our group included... can you remind me who all was in our group?
Sure.
It's been a while. I don't want to leave anybody out.
Let's see.
It was Senator Morse, Gary Temple, Bobby Regan, and Larry Glaze. And we were on the phone. I believe we had Chris Perrin on the phone that day. So our group started, and we decided to structure it by figuring out first if we had consensus on the timing of when some of these issues should be addressed, now 2011, or perhaps in a different forum by the State Board of Ed. And we started to try to go through that process first, but it was pretty easy to quickly get down in the weeds about the discussions. We did come to some general areas of agreement, and I would invite members of the group to correct me if my notes are wrong about some things that we thought that we could do in February of 2010. But first, let me talk about a couple of things that we thought needed to be addressed, but we likely could not completely tackle over the course between now and mid-November so that we could address it in February. Those included the issue of special education and virtual schools, but also special education and charter schools generally. How does the funding go? Who's responsible? How are the services delivered? How do we measure progress? Where are standardized test results reported in which district? And the group felt very strongly this is an issue that needs to be tackled, but probably was not something that we could come up with all the answers to within the next couple of weeks. We also talked about the importance of teacher training and the importance of having licensed teachers in every classroom, whether that was an online classroom or a physical classroom. And we talked about the need for those who are instructing online learning classes to have specific instruction in the specific skills and pedagogy that's needed to reach students in that kind of way. And this group also talked about the importance as we move towards using more online resources in our traditional schools, that teachers that are teaching in our traditional schools, probably also we need to look at how we are equipping them and giving them the skills that they need to use this technology in the future. We did talk about budget and that question of how should virtual schools be funded, how much should they be paid, and that was an area where we felt like we needed more information. We had some discussion about it should be perhaps based on actual cost rather than ADM, but we felt like it would take more time than what we had between now and February to determine what those actual costs were. We also were very interested in looking at the issue of student progress. How do students do that accountability of student achievement? And we started to brainstorm some suggestions about how we might start to gather gather that data, but again, that was data that we probably couldn't gather within the next couple of weeks, but need to have high on our list to come up with a game plan in order to do that. In terms of the things that we had agreed upon, that I thought that we had had some consensus around working on in 2010, we talked about, even though we didn't know what all of the answers were to the issues of budget, access, who decides, all of these things, we did agree that there does need to be a plan and that there should be a level playing field with everybody playing by the same rules. And we felt like that was something that needed to happen sooner rather than later. And we talked about that column that had things that we would send back to the State Board of Education to wrestle with, that if we did that, that needed to be with some guidance from the legislature, including guidance for a timeline of when to come back. So we talked about coming back in this group and having some more discussion about what are the questions that we want the State Board to bring back in terms of their recommendations for legislation and administrative rules, and having those come back in time for the legislature to act in 2011, which also gives the legislature time to act if the State Board has not completed that task on that timeline. We did talk about having all full-time online school programs being accredited by an organization. We talked about the need to have a list of who those approved accrediting organizations would be. And that was, I think everyone, we had a pretty diverse group, but everyone agreed that we should have be able to rely on the quality of these schools. We talked about each full-time online public charter school having an annual third-party site visit and evaluation each year. We talked about legislation that would allow the public charter school board to be fully independent from any for-profit or nonprofit organization. And this was the idea that, and to pick on Superintendent Temple, that the superintendent of a virtual school district should have as much authority over his or her school district as the superintendent of a physical school district, in the way that we generally think about them, and that would include the ability to meet in executive session without companies or vendors present. That would include the ability for that superintendent or that board to choose to change to a different vendor to purchase different kinds of materials. We also talked about having board members be residents of the state of Oregon. We talked about the information flow between virtual schools, and this kind of flowed into charter schools generally, but when a student comes into a virtual school and when a student leaves a virtual school, how is that information communicated back both to the sending district where the student lives and to the receiving district where the student is going to? So we talked about having some statutory timelines for some required information that would include who the student is, where they report that they live, where they report that they had been enrolled in school prior to coming to the virtual school, and what the date of enrollment is. And likewise, upon disenrollment or leaving the school, notifying both the place that the student reports that they're going to next and the sending or receiving district the student has left. This is where they report that they're going, and also easing the reporting of student progress, transcripts, and grades, making sure that those are easy to access. And there was the comment in the group that that really isn't just a virtual school issue, that's a charter school issue generally, and we had that discussion a little bit. We talked about how attendance would be calculated, and this group thought that it should be calculated on the ADM model rather than the FTE model. The group was very interested in really making sure that students were participating on a regular basis. The group thought that there could be some agreement on requiring that all administrators be licensed by TSPC. We wrestled a little bit with the issue of class size, and the group kind of came to the consensus that it was really more driven on the quality, and we talked a lot about contact with the students, direct contact with the students being biweekly or twice a week, and that your class size then would probably vary based on the type of student, the age of student, and so we didn't feel like we could get to any descriptor there. I think the last thing that I would mention that we talked about in our group was a real interest in asking legislative leadership to put some sort of a group together, and I would just put in a plug. This is my personal opinion. I think this group has a charge that's big enough, and maybe it shouldn't be this group. But to do a review of charter law generally, and specifically around whether or not virtual schools belong in the charter law, or if there's a different place in statute that that belongs. But within charter law, specifically also looking at some of those special ed, ELL, and finance, other kinds of things that have been challenges both for the charter schools and for the districts as they've hit the ground running. And I think that's the report from our group. It was a great group.
Does anyone from the group want to comment on Representative Galzer's presentation? Any comments from the remainder of the committee at this point? Yes.
I think Representative Galzer did a great job with our committee presentation and what we discussed. In terms of the very last thing that she mentioned on a possibility of a 10-year charter review, I think the idea was that the law has been in effect now since 1999. That some things are working well, some things may not be working as well, but most importantly, there's been some unintended consequences, things that, you know, at the time, the legislature in 1999 just didn't even think about, the idea of small districts becoming charter districts, online virtual learning, some of the special ed issues that have come up, the idea of perhaps that did ODE plan to be a charter sponsor to the extent that it is. In Portland Public Schools, as an example, we have had 30 applications, and we have 7 charters and 2 state run. You know, at what point is that going to be too much? So there was a whole variety of reasons why it seems like it's a good idea for us to be taking a look when you pass a major policy law like this, to go back and take a look and see what the unintended consequences might be and what's working. So I think I want to kind of emphasize that point. I think it's a really important one.
And I think one of the issues that came up in that discussion, there was the example of the school districts that are in litigation with one another because it was not clear to them in the statute who is responsible for the provision of special education services, the resident school district that the student lives in, the charter school district, the charter school itself, and the end result is the student is kind of delayed in getting what they need. I don't think that's anybody's intent, is to have the kids wait while we try to figure out how to untangle this all.
I would reiterate that I think the importance of taking a look at I know this bleeds over into charter school districts, which is something that's cropped up here in our state. And there's a lack of statute guiding that. And so as we look at online education, I think it's imperative that we look at all aspects of the charter school development that's occurred here, because right now we're in a situation where we really don't have statute that guides the process very well.
Right.
And exactly what you're saying, you have all kinds of issues that result because of that.
The next person is actually going to be Dana.
Oh, actually, Nikki's on the phone.
Oh. Ms. Squire, are you ready?
I am ready. Can you hear me?
Yes, you may have to. Let's see if we can turn up the mic, the speaker a little bit more. The question will be, can the mics hear?
Go ahead, Nikki.
Okay, how about now?
I think now it's fine.
Is that good?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our committee included Senator Bonamici, Representative Hoffman, Cindy Hunt, Brad Lynn, Courtney Vandeskift, and myself. A couple of general comments before I get into the detail of our ideas. One is that, remarkably, we did come to consensus. We did not have any areas where, at the end of our committee meeting, in disagreement. Secondly, after our full discussion, we came to the idea that many of the specific issues arise from the commingling of the charter school rules with online learning. And like Representative Gelser's group, for that reason, we place a very high priority, in fact, our top priority, on working out the governance model and the standards for online instruction. So, beginning then with the items that we identified to be accomplished in February 2010, our top priorities, if you were looking at your list, and I'll remind you of them, were items 8, 11, and A. 8 was the question, how should virtual schools be offered, whether that be through school districts, ESDs, charters, or through the state board. 11 was, what is the overall process for determining whether a school district should be the sponsor of a charter school that provides online instruction? And item A, of course, is the provision of curriculum descriptions and accreditation or certification standards for online schools. We think that if those questions of governance, and particularly some of the issues that have arisen because our means of offering full-time online instruction has been through charter schools, we think if those issues can be addressed, then many of the other questions that are part of this will be resolved. We also included as something that we feel needs to be tackled in February, the question of how can we assure access and accommodation of students in charters or charters that offer online instruction, including specifically what materials are basic to access the program. We know that in a regular public school, we have to assure that all students have what they need to participate without charging them money. There seems to be some question about exactly what that means for online instruction. Does everybody need to be provided a computer, for example? Just what goes into assuring access? We included in our recommendations for things to be tackled in February 2010, items 3 and 4, which are the questions regarding the method of finance and what should be the appropriate levels of funding, how will those determinations be made now and in the future, and by whom. Like Representative Gelter's group, we didn't really think that we could have a full-out plan accomplished by the end of the session in February 2010, but we thought we should have a specific outline of a plan to take action, whether it's a work group that tackles it or whatever the legislature decides. We need to know how we're going to get to the answers to those questions, who's going to make the decision, and by when. We included in our list of priorities for February 2010 item 5, which is the question, and it's related to 3 and 4, whether or not there should be additional financial accountability requirements beyond the existing law for charters offering online instruction. Here again, if we come up with a governance model that doesn't have charter schools be the primary provider, this is a question that may resolve itself. We also included for February 2010 item 7, subs A and C. That is the question of whether or not administrators of charters offering online instruction should be fit to be licensed. And like Representative Gelder's group, the definition of the requirement that teachers have biweekly meetings with students at charters offering online instruction. There seems to be a question about what biweekly means among some of the people in our group. Does biweekly mean twice a week, or does it mean every other week? That needs to be clarified. We also thought that we needed to take a look at what, if anything, needs to happen with the 50% waiver provision. Again, if charters are not the means by which online instruction is offered, that question may go away. Then we had two items that we said we would work on over the course of the next year and be ready to resolve by February 2011. Those were items 12 and 13, the assured service to English language learners and special needs students again, in charters offering OLI. The reason we didn't put them in 2010 is twofold. One, again, this issue of governance may resolve some of those questions. Secondly, it's complicated enough that it looked to us like it would take more work than what might be done in the next short while. But we wanted to get it up in that priority list to be taken care of within the next year. We suggested two items to be referred to the state board. Those were items 6 and 10. What additional reporting requirements, if any, regarding student outcomes and academic accountability would be required for online learning providers? And 10, what is the responsibility of virtual schools when students withdraw? There's a good deal of concern about students disappearing, and this also relates to the issue that Representative Delter's group identified regarding accounting for attendance purposes, and ties that into the plan probably. Then with the remaining items, we had three other suggestions. We suggested that items 1 and 14 be tabled. Item 1 is the question, what grades and ages should be served through online instruction in a charter school? We had a hard time thinking about what kind of limitations, if any, would be put on that would not cause some hardship in at least some places or for some students. We also thought, item 14, whether or not there should be additional attendance requirements for students in charters offering online instruction was something that if we account for students' attendance, probably existing attendance requirements will work. So again, it comes more down to governance and what requirements regarding withdrawals, that kind of communication will be necessary. We suggested that 7B, what teaching standards, including professional development, should be required of teachers of online courses, be referred to TSPC. And we suggested that we drop item 9, what is the appropriate student-teacher ratio slash class size. This is not something that we govern directly in other schools. We think accrediting agencies, probably some guidelines and standards are important. We were hesitant to try to come up with some kind of a standard formula. Again, I think Representative Gelder expressed this concern well, is that probably will vary depending upon the student's ages, what coursework they're doing, what needs they have. And then D, we thought that examples of policies for charter schools that offer online instruction, including policies involving online harassment, intimidation, and bullying. That's only needed as a special thing if we continue to use the charter school law as the governing structure for online instruction, and we did not make that assumption. And secondly, we think that the Oregon School Boards Association does a very good job of providing sample policies for school districts and others. So if that needs to be done, we might rely upon them as a source. That is the summary of my notes around our work with a very good group. And if there's anything else to be said, perhaps it would come from other members of the group.
Any members of Ms. Squires? Yes.
Thank you, Nikki. You did a great job of recapping, in my opinion. Regarding the classroom size, I had mentioned that I thought it was really important that we don't get creative and place more obligation and more restrictions on virtual schools than we do brick and mortar or charter or anybody else, because I think that would be an easy direction to go, since some of this is relatively new to us and we want to make sure that we're all being responsible in coming up with governance models and whatnot. It'd be awful easy to come up with over-reporting mandates. Another thing, too, was we kind of, and Nikki touched on this, we kind of kept coming back to, can we address the true answer of funding formula and whatnot until we decide if virtuals and charters are going to be addressed together as a lump. If they are, part of that may be answered already, unless we want to change it. How much control do we leave up to the individual school district or ESD, whoever's negotiating contracts, if there's going to be something on a district-wide basis? Because I can see, you know, the Fossil School District, for example, maybe contracting with K-12 or ORCA or one of the providers to provide all their fourth graders math, because they have a certified, highly qualified teacher. So, you know, who does the contracting and who's responsible? There may be different models of funding depending on who's doing the negotiating. So,
yes.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. I want to reiterate some of the points that Representative Huffman made, and also, Nikki, thank you for that excellent summary. Just to clarify on the age grade class size discussion, it isn't that those aren't critical issues, and I think that we all agreed that they were important. I think that the group felt that you can't start with those. You really have to deal with the governance first, and we thought once you deal with those issues and clarifying those, the rest of it would fall into place. So it isn't that we didn't want to address those or have those addressed. That's my understanding. It's just that you can't start there. You have to get the governance piece in place first.
Okay. Additional comments? Seeing none, I will go on to
Senator Courtney.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Just to reiterate again, I think the... I believe Representative Huffman just called it a pile or a pile of stuff. I mean, we have to untangle it. We have to undo all the interwoven issues between charters and online learning. I think, again, to reiterate Nikki's report and Representative Gelser's report, if we don't get the structure right, then it's going to continue to fall apart. I mean, it's pretty much that form follows function kind of thing. And so that the importance of that initial structure, I think, just kept coming up over and over and over. Every time we tried to wander off on one of the other issues, it came back to, well, it depends. It depends on what the governance structure is going to look like. So that just seems to be hitting us in the face as the major issue.
Any additional questions or comments? Okay, I'm going to go on to the final group, which I had. The group was made up of five versus six individuals. Representative Dembrow, Mr. Dempsey, Mark Horning, and Kathleen Scalise, the professor from the University of Oregon. The group actually kind of met in kind of a virtual environment because we only had three members present in person and two on the telephone, and Ms. Scalise could only stay for about half of the meeting. I think probably the best way to report from my group, actually, and obviously there'll be chances for the participants that are here to comment, would be to go through some of the items item by item, just so you get sort of a general overview. Some areas there were agreement, some areas there were not agreement. There was not agreement. And refreshing people's memories, too, the task here was to decide, in essence, what items we could address in 2010, what items would be for February 2011, what items might be put forward to the State Board of Education for them to come back either with recommendations or to address the issue directly. And basically just what items would be basically dropped for some future consideration of the Board of Education or the legislature. And actually the whole exercise came directly from the statute. One of the things obviously people found from the statute, which is not unusual in statutes, is that all the charges of the committees were not clear. Some of the questions that were asked or the areas seem redundant. Some could be read relatively narrowly. Some could be read relatively broadly. Reading some too narrowly might be a problem. Reading some too broadly might be a problem. So I'm going to go through the items one by one, recalling from memory and recalling from notes where I think the group was on these items. The first item that was asked for all groups was what grades and ages should be served through online instruction at charter schools. I think the group generally felt that there was actually mixed evidence out there in terms of what limited amount of studies had been done about the appropriateness of online instruction for children at certain ages, and that this group was not actually qualified at this point or did not have enough evidence before it, nor did they believe that the Department of Education would have enough in the next few months or in the next year to resolve that issue. So I think in general we thought that was an issue that should probably be dropped for now. Question two was, how can the accessibility of online instruction and accommodation of students in charter schools that offer online instruction be assured? That question can be read narrowly or broadly. You can start to read into that special needs children, but I don't think that was the intent of the question. The intent of the question was more in terms of assuring access to materials, access to the internet, and in general, I think we thought for the time being, that we had already taken those actions in the actual statute. Obviously, many of the providers were already providing those at the same that is in the statute. The next two questions are kind of the same question, but they're just worded differently. What methods of financing charter schools that offer online instruction should be used? Question three. Question four. How should appropriate levels of funding for charter schools that offer online instruction be determined now in the future by whom? That, I think, the group felt was a very important question and a question that would probably require a lot of study. Nobody, I don't think, in the group expressed an opinion that online instruction was inexpensive. They did indicate that there might be some differences in what the costs are between online and brick-and-mortar public schools or brick-and-mortar public charter schools. And I think we will have a report later this morning that will give us a lot more detail, but we'll come to the basic conclusion. I don't want to steal anybody's thunder, but we'll come to the basic conclusion that more study needs to be done on that issue. The next two questions, beyond the requirements of the existing law, are there additional financial accountability requirements for charter schools that offer online instruction that are needed? And question six, beyond the requirements of existing law, are additional reporting of student outcomes in compliance with academic accountability standards at charter schools that offer online instruction? I think in this particular area, these were items that were put forward to 2011, largely because I think we had added some additional requirements in the bill that was passed by the legislature, and we don't really have a track record with those requirements, and it would seem a little bit much to be putting additional requirements beyond those at this particular point, and not saying whether or not any additional requirements might be required in the future. There was a general sentiment about, I think, what was talked about here earlier, about trying not to place any more requirements on, I think that was Mr. Horning's comment, not trying to replace any more requirements on a virtual school than would be normally replaced on a brick-and-mortar school, but also keeping in mind that there were differences in their actual operations. Okay. Then the kind of question that has been actually is three questions in one. Shall administrators at charter schools that offer online instruction be licensed by TSPC? I think there was universal agreement in the group that they should be licensed by TSPC, and I think that's been pretty universal in all the groups that reported here today. What teaching standards, including professional development, should be required? That's something that I think actually everyone in the groups from the outside, groups with the various online charter schools have indicated that they do believe that there is some additional need for instruction to teachers on a virtual teaching environment. We, like many of the groups, indicated involvement of the TSPC, but also it's a fairly complex issue. My understanding, I don't know about ORCA, but I do know that ORVA actually does have a program for its teachers in terms of basically providing them some additional skills relative to online an online environment. The third question, there was not agreement, but there wasn't really any clear discussion either. There was a little bit of comments about should the requirement that teachers have biweekly meetings with students at charter schools that offer online instruction be further defined. The underlying problem with that is, I believe, is, and I'll be just up front, legislative council has indicated that biweekly means either twice a week or once every 2 weeks. I will tell you that my own personal opinion is it should be twice a week. I did meet with a teacher and three students and their mother from ORVA, and the teacher, without actually even asking the question, volunteered that she was required by ORVA to make two contacts with the students each week. And I think that's a fairly reasonable requirement. That doesn't mean it's an email back and forth, but it doesn't mean necessarily that it's a telephone call either. It might be just an online communication. But there's some actual contact that is actually two-way communication, just so that there can be some checking in. And I don't think twice a week, and if we actually spent more time on it, I don't think people would have thought twice a week was a particularly onerous requirement. Okay, question 8. This is the big one. How should virtual schools be offered through school districts, ESD, charter schools, the state board? I do think that there was a general concern in the group that the governance of virtual schools, virtual charter schools, should be more clearly defined. There was not probably agreement on exactly how that should be defined. There is obviously the issue that has been expressed in terms of charter schools, virtual charter schools, of whether they should be chartered by the school district and ESD or the State Board of Education or all three. There is the other question that I think is actually a question that was very apparent in the discussion that we had, and that is that the confusion that arises because of trying to place the virtual school requirements in the charter school law, and the fact that it has probably unintended consequences both for brick-and-mortar charter schools and for virtual charter schools. That's a fairly complex issue to actually address, but I think it's one where it's a little bit different from the governance issue, but I think it's one where, in my own opinion, we should actually ask the State Board of Education for a recommendation to the 2011 session on whether that should be split out into a separate chapter. I think it would make the law a lot clearer, a lot easier to read, and a lot easier to administer. Then I think we got into the area of, 12 and 13. How can students who are learning English as a second language best be served by charter schools offering online instruction? And 13, how can students with special educational needs best be served by charter schools offering online instruction? We spent a lot of time on the governance issue. But we spent also a lot of time on this. And it became a very complex discussion. Obviously, we had some people on the group that were very well informed. The discussion around, is it a virtual charter school, just like a virtual charter public school, or a brick-and-mortar public school, by law, has to meet the needs of a special needs student who walks in the door or who enrolls. There are some very complex issues there about funding. There are some very complex issues about who has responsibility for the child. Um, those issues become even more complex in the virtual environment, in a charter school environment where perhaps there's a charter school in the Tigard-Tualatin district and has a student who's from actually the Beaverton School District. It's not particularly complex. They're both in the same ESD. Services can be coordinated relatively easily. But a student who's actually a resident in the far western portion of the state, there might be a little bit of problem in coordinating services for that special needs student. But this is from our discussions, I think it became very clear that this was a very complex issue and one that probably needs further resolution, but probably isn't going to be resolved in time to put anything into statute in 2010. I missed one item, because that's an item that I think we spent a considerable amount of time on. Let's see. It's what is the responsibility for virtual schools when students withdraw? This is different from item 14 about attendance. One of the concerns in one of our lengthy discussions actually in the group was the reality that because virtual charter schools are appropriate for some students, but to some extent you will not know how appropriate they are or how the student is going to actually function in that school until they are actually enrolled, until they are actually taking instruction, there is a very high turnover rate in virtual charter schools, an extremely high turnover rate compared either to brick-and-mortar public schools or brick-and-mortar public charter schools. So we felt that there should be more communication, clearly more communication. I think the superintendent from SIO, who's been trying to do all of that, was very supportive of that at this group, even though he wasn't part of that group, so that we can actually track the students, so that when a student enrolls, the resident district knows they enrolls. When they disenroll, the resident district knows that they've disenrolled, that there's clear sharing of information. And I think that's one of the areas where we felt that there should be some action taken in 2010. I think I've missed a few items. Appropriate class sizes. Our discussion, I think, went along the same as other groups on that issue. One, there is no defined appropriate class size at the state level for brick-and-mortar schools. Obviously, we have a very broad range in terms of what that is. In terms of the number of students that a teacher has, an elementary teacher in an ideal environment, as we know from the first or second grade, hopefully might have 22 or 23 students. That might be high in some of your minds, low in some of your minds, particularly the superintendents. a teacher that is actually teaching in one subject area in high school might have 150 students in terms of how many students they interact with. We felt that it's probably far more better to look at the actual interaction between the students than any actual student-to-teacher ratio in that area. I don't know if I have missed anything. I got them all. Dana's very good. I have a few members of the group, obviously, here. I think I have all of them except for Ms. Squires.
Ms. Scalise.
Oh, Ms. Scalise.
The only thing I would add to Senator Devlin's report is I do think that probably the one thing that's come out of hearing all the discussion, and plus or 10 days ago we were at a statewide superintendent's meeting, it's quite obvious that, at least from my opinion, is that we're going to have to separate the issue of charter schools from virtual education. And once we do that, I think a lot of things will clear up and a lot of the problems that we've been facing will be addressed. And I actually think it will help with the explosion of virtual education once we separate charter school law from virtual education.
Any additional?
Mr. Chair, yes. I would just add, I think that, we're certainly hearing some consensus on a lot of these issues and the importance of dealing with the governance issue up front, the structure issue. I think, one of the areas that we also wrestled with, and I'm still not sure how we're going to ultimately deal with this, is the question of equity of access for students who may not have that home coach, the learning coach at home. to be able to access this. Is it going to be a district's response? And here I'm talking about students who are doing a full kind of charter program, because we also did talk about hybrid sorts of approaches where they may be taking particular courses. They would remain in their high schools probably, or their grade schools, and doing some courses online. But for those who are doing it full time, how do we guarantee that that's an opportunity that's available to everyone? Or should we? I think Mr. Horning raised that question of, perhaps that's just not something that will be equitable for everyone, but accessible to those who can. I think that's still a debate that has to happen somewhere. I'm not sure where that happens, but I just want to put that out. The other thing I want to say about class size, I do agree that class size really should be looked at, or student-teacher ratio should be looked at in terms of the standards of quality. So through accreditation or through policies that districts set up to guarantee that there's adequate contact between the students and the teachers. I have to say that tomorrow I'm going to be spending most of my day dealing with this issue on the college level. But we're having big debates in my own department. Interestingly, I find myself on the side of the online learning advocates, here. What we have done at my college is each different subject area has looked at what is the appropriate class size for its distance version of courses as opposed to face-to-face. They're generally a little bit lower in number than the face-to-face, and the question is by how much. But again, the whole motivation there and the purpose of it is to make sure that there is that ongoing communication between student and teacher, because when you raise the limits, there's a danger that you're going to move into just multiple choice testing and lecturing. And so how do we deal with that? Although this is not something, certainly, I think, for the legislature to set class sizes, I think it does make sense for us to set up a mechanism by which districts will deal with that issue.
Any additional comments? Oh, yes.
Bobby Regan, I appreciate Representative Dembrough bringing up the issue of the hybrid model, because that did come up in our group, and it's certainly come up in discussion otherwise, that I think there's a lot of school districts out there who are interested in providing the education of a brick-and-mortar school, but with some hybrid offerings, and we need to figure out statewide how to make that accessible and accommodating to those districts, and in particular to help districts in terms of the quality of curriculum, the quality of the teachers in the online learning environment and the rest, that there's certainly probably a need to have some full, perhaps charter, but 100% online schools. But perhaps even more than that is the need to have some hybrid opportunities.
Yes, Mr. Horning.
And I'd just like to add, too, that as we listen to all the different groups report out in terms of areas in which they thought there should be some concern and priority items, some of the things that I hear come up in our that came up in our discussions were issues pertaining to additional accountability, academic accountability measures. Obviously, we have concerns about quality control standards in regards to communication, technology that's available in class size, and then also access to technology in terms of what is available to students that are enrolled in online schools, and what is the minimum level, I guess you would say, in terms of technology that should be provided. And I guess as we enter this discussion of funding, I think we just need to take in consideration, and I would hope that we all those different things, and make sure that our minds are open to what we believe is right and is already written into the bill.
Yes. Just one observation as I was sitting here listening, thinking about how you approach contracting with a subcontractor in business. And in my business, I look at what my needs are that I don't want to supply in-house. And so I look outside for a provider. In my business model, I look at what is my need. What is it worth to me? How much can I afford to get that done? And then I go out to the contractor and I find the best fit and find out how much they're going to charge. Oftentimes what they're going to charge and what I have set up in my business model to pay maybe don't match. So you get together and you go, is my fee set in concrete, I can't afford anymore? Is their fee set in concrete, they can't afford anymore? And so there's some talk, some dialogue that goes on, and can you meet in the middle, or am I not seeing a service that they're providing? Maybe they can assist me in another area I wasn't even thinking, and their fee that looks greater on the surface actually is less because I'll save money in another area that I wasn't thinking about. My point is, as I go clear around the track, is I kind of see us sitting up here making all the decisions, but I want to know, is there going to be some point where before we put those decisions in statute, are we going to invite the providers and say, are we realistic? Or are all the providers in Oregon just going to go away because they're going to go, oh, we can't live with that model? So in my opinion, as a business guy, I think we need to have that same type of approach on this. And before we actually submit a final report, we need to make sure that our ideals are actually going to fit the reality of the virtual world for the provider.
I appreciate that comment. I do think that there's perhaps going to be a discussion at the end today about our future meetings. We technically, the leadership believes we have one more meeting. The co-chairs believe we have two more meetings.
Mr. Devlin.
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. I just wanted to sort of bring together two points that were just made. It's a bit of a reiteration, but what Representative Dembro said and what Mr. Lynn said, I think we need to consider together, because Representative Dembro made the point about addressing the issue of the students who, in the question of access, don't have an at-home learning coach. And what Mr. Lynn said was we need to make sure that students get the minimum level of technology that must be provided for account for access in looking at technology. So if we can say we can measure the amount of technology that's the minimum amount that a student needs to be successful with online learning, but if they really need to have the learning coach, I think we need to discuss that together, because I don't think that you can go out and package it, you know, find a package of learn, you know, add a learning coach in a package like you can add the technology. So it's just something that we need to continue to discuss together. If there is true equal access, we provide the technology without the learning coach, it doesn't work. So we have to have that discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Where we, I believe, intend to go from here is, you have all seen a handout, which probably should be available to the audience,
it
too.
Is.
It is. Of items, in a sense, where we have, I would say we have agreement to some degree, where we've actually started some a drafting process, which we'll hear from soon. Items where we have agreement that we need to do something to address these areas, but we're not in agreement what we will do. And I do believe that some of those may end up following into a later discussion that we have about potentially some of those items going to the Board of Education and potentially, unless we can come to agreement, going to the Board of Education and asking them to make recommendations back to the 2011 session, which would probably be appropriate in some cases. But the next item on the agenda is the items where we actually believe we have agreement and where we believe that we've had some drafting done. So is Legislative Council here? Okay. These are reflective of item 7A, 7C, and 10. This is the, so the administrators of charter schools that offer online instruction be licensed by TSBC, and 7C, how should the requirement that teachers have biweekly meetings with students at charter schools that offer online instruction be defined, and 10, what is the responsibility of school, virtual schools when students withdraw? Ms. Lade, if you'd like to do, does each one of the committees have
they're
a copy?
They're coming around.
They're coming around.
Yes.
And they're available to the people in the audience also?
As soon as we get them out here, yes.
Okay. As a word of, not caution, but this is just a preliminary draft. It's just a draft on a couple of subject areas. It's probably still subject to considerable revision, and obviously it's subject to the comments of people that here and subject to the comments of the people that are following this discussion. And we probably obviously will provide some opportunity for vendors and others to comment on our final product before we forward it to the legislature. So, yes, Senator Gell, or Representative Gell.
Nice try. Sorry.
Give it a couple of weeks.
I know, it seems to be the way it goes around here. So I just wanted to reiterate, too, that this is the start, and not only might we adjust this, we know that there are other things that we have talked about, and just because you don't see them in this draft, please don't assume that that doesn't mean that we aren't working on them. This is what's coming out of that discussion we had the other day.
Now, does everyone have the draft? Ms. Lane, would you like us to go through the draft?
Yes, Hannah Lai from Legislative Council, and yes, this is a preliminary draft. It only has about three of the issues that you will be tackling, so I'm sure there's much more to come. And to show you how preliminary it is, it's a draft to Section 8 of Senate Bill 767, which has been codified. We don't even have it in our retrieval yet, so this will all be changed to, it'll have a statute number, and we'll have all that later, but yeah, this is still so early in the process, it's to a session law. So one of the first changes that I was asked to make was related to the administrators. You'll see that in subsection 1F. It's going to be on page 2, where we now require administrators to be licensed by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Before it was only the teachers, we've now added the administrators. Moving on, the second issue would be in subsection 1K on the top of page 3, and that's that tricky situation about the biweekly, which, surprisingly enough, Webster's gives two distinct definitions, so we made it very clear that it would be twice a week is the definition we're going for. And then the third section is the subsection 1. We have M, N, and O, our new paragraphs with requirements, and that's related to notifications and records. M is related to when a student enrolls in a virtual public charter school, the notification must be given to the student's resident school district and to the sponsor. And then there's a few items that must be included in that notice that are here in subparagraphs A and B. The other notice is in paragraph N, and that's what happens when the student withdraws from a virtual public charter school. And again, the items of that notice are listed here in subparagraphs A, B, and C. And then the last item is in paragraph O, which talks about the virtual public charter school must provide students' education records to a resident school district or sponsor upon request. So those are the main items for now. Preliminarily put it for applying to the 2010-2011 school year for the first time. I don't know if that will be an issue of discussion. And, of course, we have an ECOS for July 1, 2010. So any questions?
Questions?
Yeah. There's a whole bunch over there.
Ms. Reagan.
I just have one question that popped out when you just said an amendment to provide students' educational records to students' resident school district or sponsor school district upon request.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason that you put in upon request as opposed to making it an automatic sending of the students' educational records to the resident home district?
Yes, Ms. Reagan. That was just the request at the time. It's obviously something that could be changed based on what the members here would like.
Okay. I would suggest that we might want to discuss that.
Ms. Hunt.
I actually just had some general comments about this that I think the group needs to wrestle with, which is the way the draft is it applies just to a narrow section, which is virtual charter schools, which is a group of entities that's much more narrow than I think what we've been talking about. Over at the department, in conjunction with the State Board of Ed, we've been wrestling with rules and really trying to define what is a virtual charter school. We, at this point, know that there's two, probably, but there's a whole bunch of others that may not fit that definition. So I think that one of the things us as a group has to wrestle with is that if, for example, we say that all administrators have to be licensed, are we clear that who we're talking about is just the kind of the full-time virtual charter schools, or do we intend to say everyone? And then going outside of the charter school realm, this only applies to charter schools, but there's also alternative education providers. We have virtual providers who are full-time virtual ed providers, and they're not required to have licensed teachers or licensed administrators. So I think that's something that we have to wrestle with, is who do we want all of these standards to actually apply to?
My question would be is, currently in a traditional setting, when a student withdraws and goes to another public school, let's say in this state or out of state, isn't the timeline 45 days? Do you remember what the current timeline? Off the top of my head, I can't remember. Maybe one of the other superintendents remembers.
10, I think.
Is it still 10?
Yes, okay. Mr. Dempsey, there is a statute that is already on the books that says that when a student enrolls in a school, that school is supposed to ask the previous school for information.
Mm-hmm.
This is coming out from the other direction, and when the student leaves, they have to give the information. And, yeah, I think 10 days is what
10.
The statute said, unless there's something else out there.
Yes.
Okay, so on the part about licensure, mm-hmm. is it important to identify that they need to be licensed with TSPC in Oregon? I mean, are there other TSPCs in the world?
Well,
For the purposes of Oregon statute, TSPC will always be of Oregon.
Okay.
There might be other names, other entities that are similar, but in Oregon statute, it's always the Oregon one.
Yeah.
So then the other concern I'd have about just automatically transferring records when a student leaves would be sometimes they change districts when they leave as well, so we could be sending them somewhere where they're not.
Okay.
So I think we want to wait for the records request. Certainly we want to notify them when the kid leaves. I think that's responsible.
What you're speaking of, obviously, is that you're notifying the resident district, which you are aware with the resident district, you're aware of where they live, but where the student actually ends up, you don't actually know.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
They may end up at another charter school, and a bricks and mortar charter school. They may end up being homeschooled. They may end up going back to public school. If they're not tracked, they may end up being just out of school. Yes, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. Hannah, is there a statutory definition of administrators in this section? Because I think we need to really make clear what we're talking about, the school principal, or are we talking about somebody who might be just in charge of technology? I don't know if it's just this traditional, who we would think of as school administrator, or anybody who works in administration.
Yes, Senator Bonamici. Right off the top of my head, I do not recall there being a definition for Chapter 338, which is what this section has been added to, and it would pick up any definitions for that chapter. There might be a definition in Chapter 342, which is the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I'm a little hesitant in saying that there is one. I'd have to double check.
Okay.
Can I put some further clarification on that in terms of it's clarification in terms of what I think needs to be defined? Obviously, we have small web academies where there may be just a teacher actually responsible who's already subject to another administrator within the school, another licensed administrator. There may be, I think in the case of some of the virtual school district or virtual charter schools, they have principals. I don't know of anyone that has anyone in the capacity as a superintendent. So, I mean, I think there needs to be some clarification in this. So what we're talking about in terms of licensure, what actual role that they're fulfilling, actually. Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So the twice a week meetings, I really appreciate the clarification. What would be the next step for that in terms of the definition of meeting? Is that something that would be clarified through, you know, by the department through rulemaking, or, you know, is a meeting just checking in with the student? Is, you know, do we need some sort of standard for that?
Representative Dimbro, there is some information here about it can be conference call or other technology as to what exactly is going on in the meeting. That's kind of your decision to make as to do you want to get that specific and tie it down in statute or do it in rules. Otherwise, just let it be a case-by-case basis and let the general meaning of the word meeting take over. So it's more of what this group would like to do.
Yeah.
Have we finished that line of discussion?
Yeah,
I'm going to change, so go ahead.
Yes. I mean, I would like to see that term clarified by someone, or at least some direction given, just to make it clear that we're not talking about just contact, which is going to happen anyway between teacher and student. Student has a question about that they're having an exchange about a piece of information, and is that a meeting? No, I would say not. I think the assumption of meeting is where they're kind of checking in, seeing how everything in general is going. That's my sort of common sense sense of that, that it's something that's going to take, you know, 15 minutes or something along those lines. And if that's not true, then maybe we need to specify it more.
Yes. And then Rep. Callister.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. I should know this because I've dealt with Vicki Chamberlain over the last couple of years on many, many things, but what does it mean licensed by TSPC? What does TSPC require? Do they require licensure?
Someone here in the audience.
Licensure and certification? What's...
Yes, I think they can answer your questions. If you'd come forward, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Keith Mink. I'm the Deputy Director with Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And Chair Devlin and Gelser, Representative Hoffman, when we talk about licensure for administrators through TSPC, it requires completing an approved program by our commission and along with some additional testing in order to receive that licensure. A person can come in on a transitional basis based on their education, get a transitional or provisional license, but there's usually requirements then that go with that they must be entered into a program and complete a program within a prescribed period of time.
Well, yeah. Can you define program?
An approved program, Senator Devlin and Representative Gelser, Representative Huffman, an approved program basically is one that meets certain standards that our commission sets. So, for instance, in the state of Oregon, our commission has aligned our state standards for ed leadership programs to national standards. Once those standards are set, all the programs then have to align their curriculum, their field-based experiences, and their assessments to those national standards, or to the state standards. They come before the commission, do a proposal, the commission reviews it, and then approves the program if they believe, our commission believes, that those programs meet those state standards. Once they're approved, then basically they're required to maintain accreditation by our commission on an ongoing basis. That generally runs, accreditation visits run anywhere from 5 years for the very initially approved programs, and then it goes to 7 years, every 7 years following that.
So is this inclusive of a teaching certificate, or it has nothing to do with a teaching certificate and there are other sets of standards for administrators? What I'm trying to get at is, and no offense to superintendents on the panel, but I was in a conference a week ago, and Michelle Reif, Chancellor of D.C. Schools, spoke to us, and she's a business person and economist and whatnot. She's not a certificated teacher, and so I want to make very sure, oftentimes, although I met with Dennis Hickey and Maupin the other day, he's the superintendent of Maupin Schools, and he also teaches a class. So there are situations where an administrator might be in the classroom teaching, but I know Candy Armstrong in the Dalles doesn't teach a class. She's an administrator. She's the superintendent. And so I think there can be a distinction. I just want to make sure that we're not putting something in statute that requires an administrator who arguably could be a business person with a PhD but does not have a certificate, teaching certificate. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Chair Devlin, Chair Gelso, Representative Hoffman, we do in our rules with the commission require for admittance into the Ed Leadership programs that you have 3 years of licensed experience. That experience could be as a teacher, school counselor, school psychologist. We do waive that. So, for instance, if you had someone that came straight from the business world, wanted to be an administrator, the program would request a waiver from our office. We would grant that waiver with the condition that they could be admitted into the program, but at the time that they graduate from the program, they would have to have, within 3 years, experience on one of our licenses. They can get a restricted license at the time that they enter the program. So it's not unusual in some cases for a person to come in brand new to the education field, get a restricted license to be an administrator, enter into a program, complete the program, they stay on that provisional license for 3 years, and then show us that they have that experience, have completed a program, then they get the non-provisional license. So there are pathways for individuals to come into the profession outside of education. There is a value that the commission places on someone having some education experience, and that's why they have that requirement for admission into program. But we do allow waivers, and we have granted waivers.
Just comment, yeah. Senator. In addition to what I said before, I want to make sure that we're not putting another provision on top of the local school board mandating that they can only hire certain people with certain credentials. So I just want to be very cautious as we proceed on that.
I should add a clarification there, too, in terms of who would be doing the hiring. In the virtual charter school environment, it would be the governing board of the virtual charter school that would be doing the hiring, not the school board.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes.
I just had a follow-up question.
Representative Huffman, had you finished?
The reason I bring that up, and I appreciate the clarification, was because the reason I read this, it says for charter schools.
Yeah.
It doesn't say for virtual charter school or online learning. And I know that's what we're dealing with, but if we're going to be writing statute, I just wanted to be very specific.
I think you have just identified another area, another straw, so to speak, of why it might be better to separate these two statutes and have them in separate chapters. So, yes.
And I think my follow-up question actually pertained to that, which is administrators would be licensed after completing an approved program, and I guess my question is, would that program in the online world include any elements of online learning specifically?
Chair Devlin, Chair Gelser, Ms. Reagan. Currently, our standards that we have set for ed leadership programs, we do have, if you will, a domain around technology. We have not specifically identified that into an online or distance education sort of environment.
Additional. One other clarification from my work group, actually, Superintendent Dempsey brought this up, is that there is a requirement in state law that, my understanding, that licensed teachers, in terms of being evaluated, have to be evaluated by licensed administrators. Is that true?
Chair Devlin, my understanding and is in the non-charter school realm, that is true. In the charter school realm, you can have a licensed educator being evaluated by a registered administrator.
Okay. So another clarification. Is there any other questions? Yes, Ms. Hunt.
Do we know how many administrators are just registered with TSPC right now from charter schools as opposed to licensed?
Chair Devlin, Chair Gelser, Ms. Hunt, I don't have that data available today. We could get that data for the committee if they desire.
Co-Chair Gelser.
I don't have a question on this issue. A comment.
I do have actually a comment on this issue, though, too, is that I have spent a lot of time online, actually, during the course of the development of this statute and this work group, and I have actually looked at various providers in terms of the private providers that provide services to online charter schools. I have actually found no one. I've been looking at their job listings. I have found no one who hasn't required that their teachers be licensed. So they virtually all have required their teachers to be licensed in terms of... Okay. Yes.
Clarification, you were talking specifically of teachers, though, and not administrators.
I can't remember if I saw. I've seen a lot of listings for teachers, but I can't remember if I've seen an actual administrator listing. But most of them actually post job listings online for programs. And obviously, some of them are not just Oregon. They're actually nationwide organizations. Mm-hmm. So now what we're going to do for about... Are there any additional questions? Yes. Oh, Ruth Gelson.
Thank you. I wanted to go back and revisit the question about the meeting and the guidance for the meeting that Representative Dembrough raised. And I think I agree with the intent that we want to make sure that students are having high-quality interactions with staff and with educational staff, and there's someone that's keeping track of their progress. But I also think that we need to be careful about what we put into statute and how that might roll out to other places. I think that sometimes, and I know that you don't make this error, but I think sometimes there's a misperception in teaching that the only work that happens in teaching is that work that happens when the student is directly right there, and what we don't see is the grading and the reading of the assignments and the assessment and all of those other pieces that go on, not just during the school day, but after. And so I was just scratching out quickly, if we were thinking about a middle school student and we were to say, you know, 2 15-minute meetings a week is something that would be adequate. As I watch my middle school kids in a traditional school district school, I don't know that any of them have 30 minutes a week of one-on-one FaceTime with their
teachers. And if we were to do that to those teachers, I just calculated that out. If we had a middle school teacher teaching five periods with 28 kids, two 15-minute meetings per week with each of those kids would be 4,200 minutes a week for each of those teachers. So I think we've got to figure out how do you give the guidance that it's a high-quality interaction, but we also don't want the focus to be so much on the meeting that we take away from the actual instruction.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can I just respond to that? Yeah. My intention there was not that we would define and describe in a prescriptive way in statute what these meetings would be, but I think this is something that needs to be somehow developed. Guidance needs to be developed through rule or, you know, through the department somehow just to get at what the purpose of these meetings are, what the intent of them should be. And again, you know, I don't want us to go down the path of saying, well, just because we're not doing it in the face-to-face environment, we don't need it in the online environment, because they are different. And absent the face-to-face interaction, that there may be some requirements that we need to put in place, even if we're not asking them of the face-to-face. And I think that's something that we just need to keep in mind.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My business manager and I were looking at the, I think this is a point that's relevant here, it's the Oregon Student Accounting Manual. And just for a point of information, full-time students that are enrolled in school and taking online courses only are reported on an FTE basis, okay? And they can either be 1.0 or 0.5, okay? And what it says in the manual, and this is relevant to this twice-weekly discussion that we've been having to a certain extent, it says a student must check in at least twice a week with his or her teacher on at least two separate days. Okay. If the student only checks in once during the week, the student must be counted as absent half the week. The student must be counted as absent the entire week if they don't check in. So, and this is a question I have for Brian, and I'm Brian Reeder from ODE because I'm glad he's here. We've been trying to get an answer to this question. This twice weekly check-in that's required for student attendance for these online courses if you're a full-time student, is that if I check in with my science teacher, then am I counted 2.5 days for that week for that class? Or am I counted 2.5 days for all my classes? And this gets us into a little different area, but my point being, there's already on the books a requirement that students do check in twice weekly. Now, I have some additional questions of what that all means as far as attendance and funding, and maybe we can get to that when we get to the funding discussion. But we do have some guidance already in the state and our accounting manuals for attendance on twice weekly. And I know that's been talked a lot around the committee.
One aspect that I hope we would think about in this, I know that there's the issue of attendance and funding, but separate from that, this issue of contact between the teacher and the student. Obviously, an elementary classroom teacher probably sees his or her students every hour, kind of gets an indication if they're feeling good that day, not feeling good that day, is able to identify if they're having some kind of a problem. But I don't think we should make this all at the same time overly complex for the virtual school environment, because I think what we're asking for is that there's actually just, in a sense, twice weekly, in a sense, real-time communication. Real-time meaning actual me talking to you right now, whether it's over voiceover internet protocol and we're using video cameras, or whether it's on a telephone. But I don't think in statute you want to spell it out extremely specifically, because I think statutes never should be written that specifically in this kind of circumstance, because because there are different circumstances and they should be written more broadly. But I think the idea here is just that there's some interaction, direct interaction. And I think in most cases, at least the examples I've seen, there have been clear attempts to make sure that there is that interaction between students and their teachers. But of course, your other issue is a separate issue too, the funding side of this. I think we're running a little bit beyond schedule. So what we're going to do now is take about a, I'm going to shorten it a little so you have enough time, a 15-minute break for the purpose of actually interaction between the audience and members of the committee, and for the purpose of whatever other personal purposes you have. And then we're going to come back here and we're going to try to complete the rest of the agenda by about noon, 7:30 or noon.
The Online Learning Task Force will come back to order. Welcome back from your break. It looks like we have almost everyone back, and Ms. Squire is back on the phone. So what we wanted to do was have that break so you had a chance. I know there's a lot of folks in the room that have a lot of thoughts about what we're working on here, too, and many folks on the panel are connected to all of you in the room, so we wanted to create a feedback loop based on a cursory review. So are there any new items to add to the discussion of this first draft and the discussion we had earlier in terms of where we're moving towards what we might be able to accomplish in February and what we might be doing over the longer term? It looks like you're all very, very effective at communicating on behalf of your stakeholder groups. Before we move on from this, then, I just wanted to clarify what we heard as the concerns in this draft that people felt like might need more clarification. The first was Ms. Hunt raising the issue of who are we talking about when we talk about virtual public school? Are we being inclusive enough? Is our language... And how do we structure the language in a way that picks up the full spectrum of schools we might be trying to touch with these? We did have some question about who is an administrator. Representative Huffman kind of elaborated on that a little further. We talked a little bit about whether we might need further clarification either in statute or in rule about the nature of these twice-a-week meetings, but I didn't hear any objection to the basic idea of defining biweekly as twice-a-week. We talked about the issue of student records being sent and whether that should be upon request or not upon request and whether those should be going to the resident school district or if those should actually be going to the receiving district, the place that is receiving the students.
Can I add a clarification there? Since I think the superintendent from SIL brought up a very good point, I think there's an addition to that actually in a sense. Because obviously you don't want to send the records if you know the student is attending, but there should be, somebody should be notified, again, that no one has requested the records, in essence. You know, so that if after some period of days no one has requested the records, we actually know that the student is somewhere, but we don't know where they're at.
Okay.
And I think in addition to that, part of the issue that we run into as a public school is oftentimes a kid is in an online program and they leave and we don't know that. And if we were given notification upon them leaving, then we can follow up on that and make the request. Yeah. It's possible that they may go to a different, they may move in the interim and go someplace else. But at least at the last attending school is notified, then you have an option as the attending school to contact those folks and see if you can't provide education for them. So if there were an automatic notification, then we could go and request the records.
And I think that's an important feedback loop, too, if you think about our new high school completion requirements and the need to know where kids are going so we don't kind of lose those as dropouts on that reporting. If we know where they're at, that will help us with that as well. Superintendent.
So I think what we envisioned in our subcommittee was that the notice that the child is withdrawn would go to the sending district that we knew about, and if they indicated they were moving to Portland or some other school, then we would also send that notice there so that it would go both places. So at least we'd have notice going out that the student had withdrawn.
And what do you do if it's a homeschool child?
It would go back to the ESD.
Okay.
And I think that the intent behind that was the district that is ultimately responsible for the student, where the student lives, they have a sense of where that student is moving through the system. Whoever is going to be the receiver of the records is going to be aware to be on the lookout that that student is coming in that direction. Anything that I missed? Great.
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes.
Could we do something that might be helpful to us? Could, on those particular aspects of that draft, could we ask parties in the audience to send us written comments so that we might have those?
Yes.
And to do it perhaps within the next 10 days?
I would actually suggest within, perhaps by the end of this week, we're really getting close on the timeline of getting things into to legislative council. I anticipate that the bill form, we'd like to be able to have it in a form to do a hearing in January,
yeah,
so that it is able to move through our very rapid process in February. And I think that's an important process thing to keep in mind about our work for February. A February session is very short. It is not like a six-month session, so we need to really be very timely. So please do get your written comments in to us. We'd like to hear them.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. And I just wanted to point out that I have no stakeholders here today because they're all in school. Those are the ones I'm here to represent, the kid.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. Any further comments? Yes, Ms. Regan.
Are we going to still have this discussion of remaining points of agreement, or are we moving on to the COSA presentation now?
We are going to come back to the remaining points of agreement. I understand that Mr. Reeder has come over from the Department of Ed, so I think if we can jump forward and get that report so that he can get back over to the building, and then we'll come back and be able to have further discussion.
Madam Co-Chair, I think also in some of the remaining items of agreement, part of the discussion has been that we'll have some discussion at the end of this meeting, but that we need to, Dana, we need to get some background work done so that we can put up various potential recommendations, mm-hmm, so that the committee, when it comes back for its next meeting, actually has something to work with.
Okay. Ms. Vanderstick, were you?
No.
Anything further before we invite Mr. Reeder up? Thank you very much. All right. So we are going to have a report from the Confederation of School Administrators on the costs of virtual schools. And we've got Chuck Bennett from COSA and Brian Reeder from the Oregon Department of Education. And while they're coming up, I also wanted to put on the record, people have requested different speakers, and just wanted to indicate a number of people have requested that we invite John Watson to present to this group. We have invited him on a couple of occasions. Today he has jury duty, so was not available, and I know there have been some further requests since that time that were for other speakers, and we continue to work on those. But thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Co-chairs and task force members, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Confederation of Oregon School Administrators contains a number of other organizations. We're an umbrella organization. One of them is the Oregon Association of School Executives, which is the Association of Superintendents in the state. And we also have a funding coalition which deals, it's a representative assembly of superintendents representing all sizes, geographic areas of the state. And that funding coalition was asked by the co-chairs to develop a report differentiating costs between online and brick-and-mortar schools. The objective was to determine if a change should be made in the school funding formula allocation for online school students. We had an opportunity to put together then a subcommittee which included my colleague Brian Reeder. And Brian took us through reviews of the differences between these two school models. The subcommittee also included SIO School District Superintendent and Task Force Member Gary Temple, Lynn Benton, Lincoln ESD Superintendent Susan Waddell, Yamhill Carlton Superintendent Steve Chavarro, and Salem Kaiser Online Administrator Jim Safils. We also had some help from High Desert ESD Superintendent Dennis Dempsey. The review attached was undertaken using the QEM model, and I'll let Brian run you through the entire thinking in doing that, and then I'd like to run through some recommendations that we think grow out of this information.
Co-chairs Devlin and Gelser, members of the committee, Brian Reeder with the Department of Education. When I was asked to do this, I immediately thought about using the QEM as a tool, as one approach to trying to get a handle on how the costs differ between bricks and mortar schools and online schools. And the reason I think it's a good tool is that it has a lot of detail in it. It looks at rather detailed categories of costs that schools face, and it also has the ability to change certain assumptions about those costs to do some what-if analysis for funding of schools. So what I did was develop a version of the model that can do a side-by-side comparison between what we call the baseline model of the QEM, and by baseline we mean the situation, the funding situation that districts in Oregon currently face. In other words, look at the current level of funding that we have in Oregon schools and how that amount of money is spent by school districts. So it truly is a reflection of where we are today, and that's the column in this handout that you have that's labeled Bricks and Mortar School Input 2006-07. That's where we were in the 06-07 school year. The reason we're using 06-07 data is that this model is updated every other year, and the 08-09 data are not yet available. So those will be available in a few more months, but they aren't right now. The fact that these data are a couple years old, I don't think is really a problem, because what we're doing is comparing two different models here, a bricks and mortar model and a virtual model. The key to this exercise is to really get an understanding of how the costs differ between the two approaches to education. In other words, in the context of the QEM, are there cost categories that are different between the two approaches to education? And we think there are. There's four or five key categories where it's either less expensive or more expensive to provide a virtual education than it is to provide a bricks and mortar education. Obviously, in a virtual environment, maybe not obviously, but our experience is that you need fewer teachers. In other words, the student-teacher ratio in a virtual environment is higher. That's been the experience in the existing virtual schools in Oregon. You also need fewer administrative staff in a virtual environment, but you need more support staff because there are a number of things that happen in a virtual environment that don't happen in a bricks and mortar environment. You have lots of students calling you on the phone. You have parents calling you on the phone. So you need staff to respond to those phone calls, whereas in a bricks and mortar environment you wouldn't have that. So in that sense you're trading off instructional staff for support staff in a virtual environment. Obviously in a virtual environment you have much higher technology costs. Instead of four or five students per computer, you now have one student per computer. So higher computer costs, higher server costs, clearly higher software costs, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. You have lower transportation costs in a virtual environment, although they're not zero. Virtual schools do field trips, for example. They do get together once in a while and do a field trip. You have lower operation and maintenance costs, for example, on your buildings. Now, again, they're not zero because virtual schools actually do have buildings to do certain things. Very often, students will come together in the same location for different activities. You need buildings for various other activities as well. So what we did is go through the QEM and look at all the detailed cost categories and say, how would these be different in a virtual environment? And I'm just going to focus on a few. And if you look on the handout, I'm going to just take you through the high school example, because the middle school and the elementary school example, I think, the lessons there are the same. So we'll just look at the high school example. And the areas that I want to focus on are the ones where in the final column you see the pink highlighting. These are the cases where the group felt that the differences in the costs were significant between the two different approaches. And the first one is the student-teacher ratio. Currently in Oregon schools, the student-teacher ratio is about 18.9 students per teacher. Now, this is different than a class size because teachers don't teach every period of the day. And we also have some teachers who teach, for example, English as a second language classes or special ed classes that are pull out. And so student-teacher ratio is typically lower, maybe always lower, than a class size measure. In the virtual environment, we assumed it was around 35. I think Superintendent Temple will tell you that he thinks it might need to be a little lower than that, which I guess brings up another point, is that we don't have really good data about virtual schools and about virtual charter schools in Oregon. And partly it's because the reporting requirements for charter schools in Oregon aren't the same as they are for bricks and mortar schools. So we don't have the level of detail of data for charter schools that we do for the others. So I want to emphasize that these numbers here, these estimates, are preliminary. We still have a lot to learn, and I don't think we can draw any terribly strong conclusions from the results here, but they are indicative of what we think is going on. So fewer teachers saves a lot of money. So on one side, virtual schools have fewer compensation requirements in terms of the number of teachers, and to a lesser extent in the terms of number of administrators that they need. But they do have other costs that bricks and mortar schools really don't have at all. And those are associated with the online delivery of education. In other words, the software that actually presents the content to the student. And along with that, the software that sort of manages the student's interaction with that system that delivers the content. So at the very top of the second page, you'll find the first category that's labeled in the second column, virtual school online curriculum, and that's sort of the guts of what students are learning online. It's the lessons that they get delivered to them in the online environment. And typically those are purchased from a private company, a vendor. And then the second item there is the virtual school student management system. That's what allows the student to interact with the content, interact with their teachers, interact with the online system as a whole. It's that sort of infrastructure part that goes along with the online course delivery piece. And again, that is a cost that a bricks and mortar school, if it's not doing any online delivery of its own, simply doesn't have. So here's a case where costs are dramatically higher for a virtual school than they are for a bricks and mortar school. And then further down below, they're not highlighted in pink because they're not as large, but you'll see that food services costs, transportation costs, building maintenance costs lower in the online environment than in bricks and mortar. Some of the other costs of classroom supplies, copying, and so forth, slightly lower in a virtual environment, although in some cases costs of teachers. Teachers often in a virtual school often travel to meet with students individually, and those often are very long distances. As we know, we've got students who live in Malheur County who are enrolled in Orca, so that's a 200 and some mile drive if the teacher wants to sit down with the teacher face-to-face. And they do that on occasion. So when you sort all these cost differences out, what we find is that overall, if you include both district-level costs and ESD-level costs of serving students, in a bricks-and-mortar environment, just shy of $9,500, and that's an actual, that's actually what we spent in Oregon in 06-07 per student, and that's an average statewide for each actual student, actual headcount of students. It's not weighted students, but it's warm bodies. We have about 562,000 of those in Oregon.
Riff Counselor?
Yes, Senator Devlin.
Can I clarify something there? When you said the average cost per student, what you're saying is that it's the average cost per student, but not every student has that average cost. So there's students that are going to be less in cost. There's certainly students that are going to be significantly higher in cost. Would that be? This is the average cost, but it's not necessarily indicative of the cost for any one student.
Senator Devlin, that's correct, and that's an extremely important point. When within this average, we have a spectrum of that's quite wide. You know, as you know, we have certain students, special ed students is probably the best example, where a school district will spend $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 for that particular student. We don't have a lot of those, but they do exist. On the other end of the spectrum, what we term, and maybe for lack of a better term, we term regular students who are not special ed, they're not ESL, you know, they don't receive extra weights in our formula, on average they cost below this amount, this $9,479 amount. So it's a distribution if you look at it on a student by student basis, but this is an average. And the reason that's important is the next point that I would like to make is that even though the estimate here for the virtual environment is about 30% lower than the bricks and mortar environment, the demographics in the virtual environment is different. And I think specifically we see very few ESL students in a virtual environment, although that may be changing. We see fewer special education students in a virtual environment. So far, we haven't seen any students qualifying for pregnant and parenting extra weighting in a virtual environment, and that isn't necessarily because those students don't exist, but it's under our funding law, they have to be served by a pregnant and parenting program in order to receive that weight, and online schools in Oregon are not providing those programs as far as I'm aware at this point. So in some sense, the demographics of students in the virtual environment is more on the low cost end of the distribution than students are in the bricks and mortar environment. In other words, we don't have the very high cost special education students in a virtual environment. We have few, if any, ESL students in a virtual environment. So from that perspective, it is less expensive to serve virtual students than it is to serve bricks and mortar students, simply because of the mix of the demographics.
Can I get a clarification?
Yeah.
However, there might be also a different way to look at this, in the sense, if you don't have that many students there in those categories, although I do note that there are more ESL students showing up in a virtual school environment than there have been in the past, then the lower cost that you have may be relatively much closer to what they actually receive in actual resources, too, for that student. I mean, a school district that has all this variety of demographics, the average cost may be this number, or so to speak. But the virtual school district that doesn't have those demographics also doesn't receive the revenue.
Mm-hmm. Senator,
so the number may be closer to what the actual cost is of providing the instruction.
Senator Devlin, that is correct. Right now, most virtual schools in Oregon are organized as charter schools, and under our charter school funding law, they would be receiving either 80% or 95% of the per ADMW amount that goes out through the formula, and that is in the ballpark of this number.
I was wanting a clarification about how you determine that expense or that cost around special education, and how you determine where that's being served, since the cost and the responsibility for the provision of the special education services remains with the resident school district, and yet the student is enrolled in the virtual school. Where is that? How did you make a comparison? How did you account for that here?
Representative Gelser, we account for that in, well, let me start with the standard QEM. We make an assumption in the standard QEM, what we call the bricks and mortar version in this document, that I believe 13% of the students in this prototype school are special education students, and therefore there are teachers and other resources that are devoted to those students. So we have, in essence, more staff in the bricks and mortar environment than we do in the virtual environment, because we've assumed that those special education students aren't being served in the virtual environment. They're being served in their home district, and the costs are being borne in their home district, and that revenue from the extra weight in our formula is going to their home district, not to the virtual district.
I've received emails. I don't know if you've received lots of emails from people about this issue, Senator Devlin, but I've received a lot of emails about virtual schools, and a number of them seem to be from families that have kids with autism or Asperger's syndrome, for instance. So that virtual school is not getting any additional funding for that student with Asperger's or autism. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, how do we figure out what the number of students who are in special education that are in a virtual school is if we can't track that through the ADM count? Because their scores show up, it seems like it's not through assessment, because their scores show up and they're credited to their local or their resident districts, and we can't necessarily track it through the distribution of the weighted ADM, because that also goes to the school district. Is my question making sense?
Representative Gelser, it is making sense, and maybe Gary can help me with this. My understanding is that under current law, that if a special education student is enrolled in a virtual charter or any charter school, that they are still considered to be a resident of the district where they live, and that is different than a non-special education student. And so for funding purposes, both weights are counted in the district where they live, and then the districts enter into an agreement about how much will be forwarded to the charter school district. Now, my understanding is also that SIO had started out doing that differently early on. They decided to split the weights before the department had given guidance on that question, and we have allowed them to continue. So the first weight flows to SIO, and the second weight flows to the district where the student lives. And in our data collections we can tell of those students enrolled in ORCA. We know which district they live in, so in some sense we know who they are and where they live and where they're going to school. And we also can keep track of the money flows. And what this exercise tries to portray is that the virtual school gets one weight, funding enough resources from one weight, and that the home district gets the resources from the other weight. So in that sense, this comparison in essence assumes that the virtual school is relying on the home district to provide special education services, because that's where physically the student really is. But it may not be quite as clean cut. For some types of disabilities, there are ways to serve those students online, and I don't know whether ORCA actually does much of that or any of that. There's a gray area here on exactly which district is providing the special ed services and which district isn't. But I think from our data collections, we do know where the students are, where they go to school, and where the money is flowing.
Okay. Thank you.
And I guess that brings up another point, is that these comparisons are not perfect. We have some certain activities that virtual schools simply can't do. If a special ed student needs some sort of one-on-one interaction with a teacher, obviously the virtual school has a hard time doing that, since the student is possibly 200 or 300 miles away from the school district where the virtual school exists. So that's where the cooperation between the two districts in serving that student is so important.
Are there other questions at this point before he continues? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gelser. I wanted to ask for an explanation, and maybe it's just me trying to go back and forth between columns here, about curriculum, because that's one of the pink areas. I'm looking at the high school page. And for curriculum development under building support costs for the brick-and-mortar schools, it looks, if I'm reading this correctly, like about a third of curriculum costs for the virtual school. So is it really apples and oranges? Brick-and-mortar schools need to develop curriculum as well. So why is it so much more expensive for the virtual schools, or is there some other difference I'm missing? Because it looks like the management system is in another category.
Co-Chairs Devlin and Gelser, Senator Bonamici, you're correct. Down under building support costs under curriculum development, we've got $104 per student in there, and that comes right out of the financial data that school districts report to us. And up above, the curriculum piece for the virtual schools is $300, roughly $300 per student. And that $300 per student, or $300,000 in this 1,000-student high school, comes from the information we have about what the vendor is charging. I believe that came from ORCA. $300 per student is the charge from the vendor to supply this online system of course content. So in some sense, it is apples and oranges, because curriculum development in a bricks and mortar setting, and much of this happens on a district-wide level, is a narrower activity. It doesn't include the delivery to the student. That happens in the classroom. Under a virtual environment, the development of that course content and its delivery via the internet happen simultaneously. In other words, it's a different product. In some sense, it's both the content and its delivery for the virtual school. For bricks and mortar, it's just the content, and the delivery is captured in another part of the model, in the classroom piece, the teacher piece.
Well, just to follow up then, can you define what the management system is then?
And maybe Gary could jump in here and help me a little bit. It's the management system. I mean, think about it as the internet versus a particular website. You know, I can go out on the internet and that allows me to do all sorts of things. And that would be analogous to the management system where I can send emails, I can do all sorts of things. I can pay my bills. But a particular website is a much more focused thing. It may be a particular company or organization has a website. So the management system is what allows the student to interact with their teacher, to look at their grades, to find out what their attendance has been. The curriculum piece is the course content. They go in there and they're doing a math class or a science class or, you know, part of a math class. Today they're doing binomial equations, and so that's the curriculum piece, and the management piece is the infrastructure that allows them to interact with that and with their teacher and their principal, and allows the school to interact with the parents and so forth.
Okay. Thank you. I'll follow up a little bit on that, because if the delivery part is part of what explains the additional cost, I'm just wondering how much of the delivery is in the management system, but I'll look into that. Thank you.
Senator Bonamici, this makes more sense to me this week than it did last week, because I visited SIO last week and had a chance to see what that management system was. So as opposed to if I'm the student and I sit down and I log into my class and I go and I, you know, watch my teacher giving the live lesson, or I watch the video, or I take the test, I have that information going back and forth. If I'm understanding this correctly, the management system is where the teacher sits down, they see all of the students that are assigned to them, they're able to track, you know, for each student how many minutes they spent working on each class each day, their attendance levels, the amount of teacher contact, and what types of contact they'd had with each of those students every day. So it was, I kind of thought about it as like our Legicon or our, you know, our constituent database where we manage that work, as opposed to the information that we might send out in our newsletters, our emails, our communication. Thank you.
I guess another point that is important to make here is that because these two components here, the online curriculum and the student management system, are purchased from a vendor, we don't have any information on the cost structure of that, but what we do believe is that there are economies of scale in those systems. So once those systems are built, adding one more student from the perspective of this vendor doesn't cost them much, if anything, more. It's sort of like Microsoft selling me a copy of Word. You know, they can generate another copy of Word for a penny or two, but they don't sell it to me for a penny or two. They charge me $300 and some because they have huge fixed costs up front to develop that program. It's similar here. The vendor develops their management system and their curriculum, and then they sell it to school districts. They typically sell it on a per-student basis, $300 or $500, but their cost structure is different than that. The cost of selling one more copy of that to add one more student is probably quite small, but we don't know their cost structure because they're a private company. And I've looked for studies of what that cost structure looks like, and I don't find any out there, because most of these delivery systems are provided by private companies.
So one other question that I had about the comparison has to do with textbooks and consumables and, you know, kind of the hands-on materials. And last week I also visited a really sweet little girl in Corvallis and was asking the teacher about the box of materials that she had received from the company. And this was Orva. I don't know if Orca does it in a different way. But at the end of the year, they're asked to send back whatever they can send back for reuse. But the teacher indicated that she had never seen a student not receive a completely brand new box of materials. So I'm wondering about that comparison in you know, Corvallis School District, for instance, if we adopt a curriculum and textbooks, the first graders that go through in 2007 fall use those textbooks. In 2008, those same students use the textbooks, and those same textbooks are used over and over again for maybe a decade until there's another textbook adoption. How do you manage that in a virtual school environment, and does this number reflect that similar practice of cycling them through, or does it assume that, like Orva, everybody's getting a brand new book every year?
Representative Gelser, I believe our assumption here, and this was a bit of a surprise to me, that virtual schools are actually using textbooks, hard papery things, as much as bricks and mortar schools are. My assumption going in was they don't use textbooks very much at all because they have all this online stuff that's on the screen. They don't need textbooks, but apparently they use textbooks and other kind of materials just as much as bricks and mortar schools do, and that's why in the model here we've got the same amount of spending on textbooks for virtual schools that we do for bricks and mortar. The assumption would be the same for both environments, is that that textbook is returned by the student at the end of the year and can be used for another student the next year for the next class, and that the replacement cycle is similar for both environments. Some of the other classroom materials are slightly lower for the virtual environment. You know, just as an example, a lot of schools send home copies of things with students for their parents regularly, a couple times a week. You don't need to do that in an online environment because the parent can log on and get that information electronically. So some of those costs are lower for virtual schools, but some of them are just as high as they are in a bricks and mortar, because they do use a lot of paper material, more than I thought they did, but apparently they do.
Yes, Mr. Lynn.
Yes, I had a question about one of the costs that you listed in your 0607 report in regards to student transportation. Is the number that's listed under brick and mortar, does that take in consideration the federal reimbursement that usually that's kicked back to the district after the year's up?
Here, Gelser and Devlin, Mr. Lynn, I'm not aware of a federal funding for transportation.
It's
probably the tax on the fuel. Actually.
Yeah,
that's what.
And it's usually about 75%. The state.
This amount is what they actually spend, and so it would, the way our transportation funding works in Oregon is districts are reimbursed for a percentage of what they spend.
Mm-hmm.
70%, 80%, or 90%, depending on the district circumstances. So this would be their actual expenditures, and they would be reimbursed for a large share of this, but this is the total of what they spend. This is a spending side model, not a revenue side model. So
okay.
This includes all their costs, no matter where the funding comes from.
Okay.
You, Mr.
Chairman. A clarification here, Madam Chair.
Oh, yes, Mr. Glaze.
Oh, just a question.
Question.
Okay. Brian, earlier in the discussion, I'd brought up the issue of FTE, counting FTE, as opposed to the way that public schools do for online charter schools, full-time students. Can you talk a little bit about that and what the differences are?
Co-chairs Gelser and Devlin, Mr. Glaze. When online learning started in Oregon, I guess not online learning, but the advent of fully online schools, the department had to grapple with the question of how to count attendance and ADM for those students. Attendance matters for a couple of reasons, and ADM obviously matters for funding. And so we devised some guidelines for school districts to use, and we came at the problem or the issue from the perspective of of the student and providing flexibility for the student in terms of the way learning happens in a virtual environment, but at the same time trying to provide enough accountability so that we were confident that, particularly for funding purposes, that we were actually getting something for what we were funding. And so what we did, and I guess I'll weigh in on the biweekly. What does biweekly mean? The words mean every other week, but the intent was twice a week. I'll just state that up front. What we said to school districts, and these are in the form of guidelines, was that in order to demonstrate that the student is making progress, that we would require that the student check in with their teacher twice a week, and that the student be making academic progress sufficient to satisfy the teacher that they were learning what they were supposed to be learning at a rate that the teacher thought was appropriate. And if they did that, then we would count them as present versus absent for that entire week. If they only checked in once, then they were absent for half the week, and if they didn't check in at all, they were absent the whole week. And if they went for 2 weeks in a row without checking in at all, that meant they were absent for 10 days in a row, and under the 10-day rule for ADM, they had to be unenrolled, and therefore the district would no longer receive ADM for that student. That was where the twice-a-week check-in proposal came from. It was about attendance and about ADM. The discussion here today was beyond that. It had more to do with whether it's appropriate and how much contact and discussion a teacher should have with the student and how often. But it started with a much narrower focus regarding attendance and ADM. Now, another question that Mr. Glaze asked me is that, does that mean they have to check in with all of their teachers or just one of them? And I guess in a high school and a middle school environment, most students have multiple teachers. Since the intent of the rule was to make sure they were making progress academically, my response to that would be that they really should be checking in with all of their teachers, not just one of them. It doesn't help to check in with your science teacher if you aren't doing your social studies homework. So in terms of judging, for the teachers to be able to judge whether the student's making progress, each of the teachers really should have some contact with the student on a weekly basis.
And Mr. Bennett, did you have a clarification you wanted to make on the transportation?
No, I think it got...
Okay.
Thank you, though.
Okay. Great. Superintendent Temple.
So, Brian, you've mentioned that you think costs are less than what I would have in my regular brick and mortar. Kind of following up with Senator Devlin's comment, where are you at on revenue? Are online schools receiving the same amount of revenue as I am in my brick and mortar?
Well, Coaches Devlin and Gelser, Superintendent Temple. Online schools in Oregon, as far as I know, at least all of the full-time ones, are all charter schools. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but most of them are. Orca is, I believe. So they're funded under our charter school funding provisions, which say that the sponsoring district pays the charter school either 80%, a minimum of, actually the way the law reads, a minimum of 80% for elementary, 95% for high schools of the district's formula funding or general purpose grant, technically, per ADMW. So in that sense, given their demographics, and given that they're likely not receiving some of the other sources of revenue that school districts have, federal money in particular, they probably are receiving lower funding mean, clearly they're receiving lower funding per student. Part of that is their demographics. Part of it may be other factors. I haven't done a thorough evaluation of that, but you know, the key factor is that they're, because they have fewer extra weights than a bricks and mortar school typically, then they are being funded at a lower level per actual student. But part of that's driven by demographics.
Co-Chair Devlin.
Oh, go ahead. A clarification on that, though. I can't recall specifically, but my guess is right now, given what adjustments that we've made in the overall state school fund, not including extra resources that school districts receive, not including specialized resources they receive from the federal government, but the actual amount per ADMW is in the range of taking away the transportation grant, probably in the range of $6,100, $6,200, somewhere in that range.
In that ballpark, yeah. I don't have that number in my head.
Yeah. Which is relatively equivalent to your cost, or lower than your cost.
Senator Devlin, that's correct on an ADMW basis, but not on a headcount basis. And
okay.
These numbers are on a headcount basis.
Okay.
So we need to do a little more work if we're going to try to put it in the context of the formula.
Can I get a clarification here, madam?
Yes, please.
If you don't have the demographics and don't have the weighting for the demographics, although you may get, as we've indicated by looking at some of these numbers, there are a few more ESL students entering virtual schools. There obviously are some students that are special needs students entering virtual schools. There's a question about who gets the weighting for that. But the difference between the ADMR and the ADMW has to be very close together, because there's not a lot of weighting factor there.
Senator Devlin, that's correct. If you look at, as a statewide average, ADMW is about 24% higher than ADM.
Yeah.
In a virtual environment, it's probably between 7 to 10% higher than ADM.
Okay.
So you're correct that the number of extra weights in the virtual environment is smaller. And therefore, if you believe the weights are a reflection of cost drivers, then the costs in the virtual environment ought to be lower as well. And this exercise that we went through suggests that that's the case. But what I would say is there's a fair amount more work to be done to better understand this. A big part of that has to do with demographics, and a big part has to do with the portion of the services purchased from vendors where their cost structure is a black box to us.
I have one clarification as well on the ADM. When there are no weights included, does that also mean that there are no small school weights? So, for instance, would a student that enrolls in SIO or in ORCA from Spray, which would be a small rural school that would maybe get the small rural elementary school grant, would SIO receive more for that child than they would for a child that enrolled from Corvallis, or is it just the base first weight?
Representative Gelser, they would not receive the small school weighting. The small school weighting is based on where the student attends.
Okay.
So if they move to ORCA, then that extra funding does not go with that student to ORCA.
Does the extra funding stay with the small school district, or when the student goes to ORCA, does the school district lose both that first ADM and that enhancement for being a low enrollment small school as well?
Representative Gelser, the small school correction is based on the enrollment in the school. It's not attached to individual students, so in essence that school district that the student left, that makes their school even smaller. And so their small school correction would adjust accordingly.
Thank you. Ms. Vanderstick. Oh, no. Yes, Mr. Dempsey.
Question, Brian, was there, are there not several virtual schools online that are run in traditional brick and mortar school districts currently in Oregon?
You're referring to Web Academies, probably. Web Academies?
Yeah, well, when you're talking about here virtual schools, the costs that you came up with in the three, I'm just going with the three pink areas. At that point, I assume the assumption is that nobody at this point in one of the K-12 districts in the state is running an online school. And that's why the numbers were zero.
Co-chairs Gelser and Devlin, Mr. Dempsey, that's correct. The assumption in what we call bricks and mortar here is that they're not really doing any online education. Now, obviously, we have some doing it. Salem Kaiser is a great example. They have a pretty large online. It's not really a school. Right. It's a program.
Okay.
But the operating assumption here in, for this comparison is that the bricks and mortar school is not really doing online education.
Another question would be a follow-up is, okay, so the other assumption is, and this may be a poor question, but if I'm a K-12 superintendent and I decide that I want to go through either a private vendor or a charter school that's providing this service in the state, my cost, the assumption here is that the cost at the high school is the same at the middle school, the $500,000 and the $300,000. The truth be known, you would half that, wouldn't you, if the cost, if you're using two or three schools, or does each, what I'm trying to get at is we're saying here the cost to provide online education in 06-07 was $300,000 for curriculum and $500,000, but the reality is the more you have, your cost would go down theoretically, right? The more people that you're accessing it. So if I'm a school district and I have five schools that are going to access it, theoretically the cost would be one-fifth, right?
Well, Co-Chairs Gelser, Devlin, and Mr. Dempsey, that's back to the point I tried to make about the pricing structure versus the cost structure of private vendors. If you're buying it from a private vendor, they might be willing to negotiate with you and say, well, if we're serving 3,000 students instead of 1,000, maybe we'll lower the price from $300 to $250 for the content. But I doubt they're going to give it to you for nothing.
No.
They tend to sell their product on a price per student served. In other words, they're capturing the economies of scale rather than allowing the school district to capture the economies of scale. Mm-hmm. Now, if you provide that, the school district were to provide that themselves rather than purchasing it, then they can capture those economies of scale for themselves, and adding a bunch more students may come at virtually no cost.
And those costs, as a follow-up, could be impacted whether you're buying a CAN management system or you're actually purchasing an open-source one where you manage it yourself.
That's correct. And that's why I tried to make the point that one of the key aspects here is this sort of black box to us cost structure of these vendors. You know, we don't really know what their costs are. We know what they're charging school districts in Oregon, but we don't know what their costs are. And we don't know how much they go up, if any, by adding additional students to the system.
Thank you.
Are there further questions before we let them finish their presentation and move on to the recommendations?
Madam Chair, thank you. You had asked us then, in after working with Mr. Reeder, to really begin to work with these numbers, and you can see how interesting these numbers are to work with, to make some recommendations, particularly around the funding formula. And we found, and I hope this is very clear by the amount of times we put the term draft on this, that we view these as extremely preliminary numbers frankly do not believe that at this point there is any justification for changing the funding formula for several reasons. One, the numbers are preliminary. Two, it just doesn't fit with the kind of philosophy of the state's funding formula for public education, which is based on a formula related to student characteristics, not to delivery systems. And this question of whether or not this delivery system results in a change in student characteristics because they're using online education would be very problematic. So we'd ask you to not take a look, at least at this point, unless we find out something different in the future. We ask you not to come forward with anything related to the funding formula. We just don't think it's appropriate at this point. But we did have some funding, we believe some funding-related recommendations. Brian mentioned the black box nature of this system, which I will just use not to characterize the system. It makes me a little uncomfortable to use the term black box, but we don't know what's going on in private online education. So we would suggest that you create a transparency in the funding reporting process here, these particular kinds of charter schools, including use of ODE's database initiative standard chart of accounts, so that the same objects and functions are reported for these charter schools as brick and mortar. We just need to have apples and apples. And we know that folks don't like reporting, particularly in these private businesses, what's going on inside them, but we need to have a look if you want to know whether there is a need to change these kinds of funding-related issues. We also suggest that you require charter schools using online providers follow state purchasing standards, including an RFP process. There are now enough of these providers on the scene here in Oregon contacting school districts for us to believe it's time to go to the more standard purchasing process you use for other kinds of delivery systems, which is an RFP process. It will create competition. It will help, it will result in the creation of some basic standards for these provider systems. We think it opens the whole system up. And to have this be single source at this point in its history just flies in the face, we think, of basic public contracting law. And then we just, in addition, in the funding area, would like to have you review the enrollment status of ELL, special education, and other student categories in online programs. We're having trouble understanding why they're so underrepresented. And we'd like to know that there is absolute access to these online programs for these special status students. And for it to be as substantially different, we think there may be some problems there in access. So we would ask you to look at that. In addition, the OASE Funding Coalition had some other recommendations we'd just like to share with you. My colleague Craig Hawkins from COSA would like to share those with you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs Devlin and Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Craig Hawkins from COSA. The Funding Coalition has 42 voting members, superintendents at Representative Assembly that Chuck mentioned. But the Funding Coalition meetings aren't limited to those 42, and I would say that at the meeting about 10 days ago, something like double that number were in attendance, so 80-plus superintendents from around the state participated in the conversation. And of course, when you have 80-plus superintendents in a room, limiting their conversation to strictly financial on an issue like this is a challenge. So, but that was a good thing in this case. And you see the number of their recommendations sort of reflect a discussion that we heard this morning. And that includes sort of this separate virtual and charter school conversation. Think of it as what Ms. Vandersteg said about the pile and untangling the straws. I think that was very similar in our conversation. State standards conversation was there. A number of tables, we had spoken to small table discussions, reported back that they thought that we needed to improve state strategy overall. And one suggestion is that there was a report developed related to statewide online or virtual education about 4 or 5 years ago that was a partnership. Suggested a partnership between Lynn Benton, Lincoln ESD's Cool School, SK Online, Portland State Community College, and other districts that had sort of some thoughts about where to go. We're going to get that today and provide it for you. I think it just provides good background on one alternative and along the lines that superintendents were talking about a couple of weeks ago. The point that was made earlier today around communication between home, receiving district, sending district, was an important point for superintendents as well. And then the last point here relates to the whole conversation about moving to sort of this hybrid world in terms of brick and mortar and virtual school education, and the barrier presented when virtual schools require full-time student attendance as opposed to something that allows more of a blend to meet the needs of kids. So that was something that was a concern for superintendents.
And finally, Madam Chair, we wanted to thank you again for the opportunity to work on this issue. One of the realities we think that the legislature is going to need to come to grips with in the next session or two is that we're looking at a hybrid model out there. This is really where we seem to be headed, is a bricks and mortar and combined with online opportunities, and that is expanding. And Gary has taken us through this discussion. He's been really helpful in working with us on this, and I think his analogy that this is a stopover on the way toward that hybrid model, and what I hope you will look at during this, whether special session or regular session, is how to facilitate that movement in our school districts, that this idea of a single online school district or a single brick and mortar school district is going to be dated to perhaps less than a decade of discussion, and we will be talking about a more comprehensive kind of educational opportunity. And it's going to require some serious discussion and rethinking, but until this stuff gets standardized, we have clear standards and in reporting, standards and guidelines in the quality of education available to students that includes both brick and mortar and online, and reporting requirements, we think that is slowed down. So we're really hoping you can move this along. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any, I thought Superintendent Glaze had a question.
Yes. Chuck, I'm curious. I wasn't able to make the off-the-record meeting, but curious about a couple of things. It looks like you came up with a figure saying that it's roughly 70% cost of educating online kids compared to brick and mortar. Interested in what your thoughts were as a committee regarding next steps. Where do we go next to feather this out and get a more precise definition of what is the appropriate funding level? And then also, I don't know, I think I heard through the grapevine that the group discussed the whole issue of what is the best vehicle for delivering online education for the state of Oregon. Would it be better to have one source delivering that? Would it be better to have ESDs in charge of that for the sake of consistency and standardization, or the current system which we have, which is somewhat of a hodgepodge going on? Interested in the COSA discussion regarding those issues.
Well, I hope, Madam Chair, I hope, Larry, that it's real clear in our recommendations that at least in terms of your first question, the creation of transparency is just absolutely essential. We have got to get down to apples and apples, oranges and oranges, and right now, and based on Brian's review, the number that shows up is about 70%. Mm-hmm. We don't have any confidence in these numbers until we can see how the whole thing looks, but we're certainly willing to work with it. We do think it's probably close enough that there just is no reason to look at the funding. What we were asked to look at, which was whether or not there ought to be a change in the funding formula. We just don't think there ought to be that you should be recommending any changes in the funding formula. Wrong philosophy, and the numbers are close enough that we're just not, and we're not confident enough yet in the numbers to urge you to do that. So I thought that was, I hope that's real clear. But this reporting requirement we think is a very big deal, that we get same function and object, same chart of accounts as the database initiatives from these companies so we can see what's going on there, and it's comparable. And your second question was, say it again, single source. Well, we supported that. I mean, originally, if you'll recall, and it might be interesting to someday, and maybe you've already had the guy from ODE in that supposedly runs the state's virtual school district, and hear from him whatever happened to the state's virtual school mm-hmm. district and where have they gone with all that money. That would be interesting to us, but and that's Craig's recommendation, and I think it's Susan Waddell's report that we're going to be providing to you, which is a proposal on how perhaps to create a single state virtual school district. The question you kind of asked yourself is, if the state isn't going to do it, how come we didn't contract with ORCA? I mean, why do we not have a statewide virtual school district? And in some ways, we almost do, and it came out of SIO. You know, I mean, I'm not sure that's the right way to go, but the idea was at some point to have resolved this at a statewide level. It just never happened. And we need an answer on why it didn't and what are we going to do about it.
Co-Chair Devlin.
I might be able to clarify part of that. Probably want to get some clarification from Mr. Bennett on some other things. The state virtual school district was never meant to be a provider, actually, like ORCA.
Well, it was actually meant with you on that,
yeah,
Mr.
But it was
that
actually
wasn't our understanding when the funding went to that model. We thought it was to come out a state virtual school district. What would that be?
Actually, what it basically was and what it basically is a common portal for all virtual school programs in the state that are offered by public schools. Actually, some programs that are offered by others, but I do not believe at this particular point that it offers any programs where there are actually teachers connected to those virtual programs, which is what a virtual school district would actually be. If it did, it would require significantly more funding. Looking at an example of a different model, like you have in Florida, it would require significantly more funding than $1.5 million, $1.8 million per biennium for it to be that. I did want to ask a couple of questions about the recommendations, though. In the statute that was passed, there are some additional reporting requirements for virtual charter schools. There are some requirements for vendors providing services to virtual charter schools. Some of those provisions for vendors are sort of direct. Some of them are more at the request. You know, if you request the information, it's provided. What you're basically asking for is that the information be provided in the common format that school districts have all agreed upon so that you can compare apples to apples. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I understand that. I wanted to clarify one minor issue in your sort of sub-recommendations. Require online schools to accept both full and part-time students. I just have to get a clarification of that. I don't know, the issue about requiring is probably an issue within itself, but if you did require, wouldn't you basically have to, or is there a way that you would simply adjust the formula that you would state, and that might be a question for Mr. Reeder, if a student is attending 2/10 of a time, do they get 2/10 of weight? I mean, if you require, you've got to figure out a methodology for payment then.
Senator Devlin, under current law, a student can only be on the active roll of a single school.
Okay.
So that doesn't prevent a student from attending two different schools, but if that happens, then if they're in two different school districts, then the districts work out who gets how much money. And so in the funding formula, we pay only one district, and if the student is attending part-time in another district, then their first district makes a payment under an agreement between the two districts. We don't have a mechanism for splitting the ADM between two different districts because the law doesn't allow that right now.
Okay.
Now, we could do that if the law were changed, but...
Okay. So the issue is basically a little bit more complex.
So the issue is because that by law, even though we've created an exception for special ed students who technically are being served by two distinctly separate districts, even though they are one distinctly single child, we in our district for homeschool students, we worked out an arrangement with homeschool students where homeschool students might come in and take a lab science class or an AP literature class and homeschool for the rest of the day, and we were getting that 2/10 of an ADM. But the problem, that worked because you weren't sending dollars directly to that homeschool family. And in this case, you would be sending both to ORCA and to Albany School District, to GAPS.
Representative Gelsinger, that's correct. The law has always allowed homeschoolers to take courses at their local school district, and the school district gets funded for them on some basis. ADM typically is counted for registered homeschoolers using a formula, but the district does get funding, but the distinction there is that student is enrolled in only one school. The alternative case is where a student wants to be enrolled in more than one school, and the question is, how do we fund that? Under current law, we give the money to, those two schools happen to be in different districts, we give the money to one district, and the two districts come to an agreement about how much is going to be paid. Conceivably, we could change the law to say, by some formula, we could divide the ADM up so that no agreement between the districts would be necessary. The state would simply send the money to where it needed to go.
Thank you. Did you have further questions? Are there further? Yes, Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on the access to information, the transparency piece. So, as the Senator mentioned, there are transparency requirements in 767. Are those of use to you? This information now is supposed to be on file with the sponsoring districts. Presumably, you now will have access to this information. Would that help you as you're trying to calculate and refine these numbers?
Co-Chairs Gelser and Devlin, Representative Dimbrough, it certainly will help us. I think I'm in the cynical camp. On this other, that when if we try to get the vendors to give us a breakdown of their costs, somewhere in their cost breakdown will be embedded their profit margin, and it ain't going to say profit on it. So they can tell us that they have X people working on programming, and they have Y people working on maintaining their servers and all that stuff, but even with that level of detail, part of the information we would really like to have is, what's their profit margin? Are they making more than the market would dictate if there were true competition out there? And if the answer is yes, then one solution is to create some competition, and that goes back to the recommendation that there be a bidding process to create some competition that we don't really have now.
Right. So if I could just follow up. So though the statute requires them to report their profit margin, your sense is that may be just one piece of their margin, and there may also be some padding in some other categories. Is that what you're saying?
The cynic in me is saying that.
Okay. And just one further follow-up. Do you know if the department has, requested to see this information now that it is required statutorily?
I don't know that the department has requested that. I personally haven't requested that.
I represent.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And this is probably what Representative Denbrough was asking, but just I wanted to be a little more specific. Do you have reason to be cautious? Has the district asked ORCA what profit model do you work on? Have we asked any of the virtual providers, or are we being cynical for maybe no reason?
Co-Chairs Gelser and Devlin, Representative Huffman, I'm not aware that the department has specifically asked SIO or any other school district to ask their vendors for a detailed cost breakdown. One of the things we hear regularly is that online education ought to be dramatically less expensive than bricks and mortar, ranging from a quarter of the cost to three quarters of the cost. And why isn't it? And one answer is that because of lack of competition among vendors, that school districts are paying them more than they really need to get that product. And it's back to your example. Can you sit down with your contractor and come to an agreement about, if you don't have enough, you don't have as much to pay as the contractor's offering the service, can you negotiate over that and come to an agreement? Well, presumably you have a bunch of different contractors you can choose, and they're competing with one another. But in the world of online schooling in Oregon, we don't see that competition. It simply doesn't exist. These vendors show up at the door of school districts and say, we want to start a charter school. And nowhere was there a bidding process where those vendors, multiple vendors, made proposals to that school district and said, I can do what you want done for X dollars. And this one says, I can do that same thing for Y dollars. That has never happened in Oregon.
Ms. Squire, are you on the phone? Do you know if the state board has asked for that information in your process?
I am on the phone. When we were doing reviews of proposed providers who came to us for asking for a waiver of the 50% rule, we asked for very comprehensive information. We got comprehensive information about program, particularly curriculum. We found the financial information that we got was, I won't say withheld, but it just wasn't apples to apples. It wasn't put together in the way that the state chart of accounts works, and it was difficult. We didn't ever know. Although it was discussed in our meetings several times, what part of the expenses that we were seeing had to do either with two questions that came up, profit or marketing. And I think that the reason for that is that what we were seeing was more what the nonprofit board's budget looked like. And it was budgets that were put together in, I'm going to say, larger units than what we would see in a typical school district budget. So we weren't seeing the private corporations counted. What we were seeing was a budget that the board for the virtual school had put together, and then we could see, of course, their charter with the local school district.
Thank you. Co-Chair Devlin.
Can I get some clarification here?
actually, all the testimony we're receiving in this area is further basically making the case that we probably shouldn't take any action on the funding formula for virtual schools, but that there's probably further study needed.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of items I wanted to get on the record is, one is that it would surprise me if any virtual school provider of services, being the private vendors, wouldn't be in this to make a profit, because if they're in business and they're not in it to make a profit, I would wonder why they were in business.
Could they remain in business?
Or could they remain in business? However, if your estimates are correct earlier, I clearly understand the issue about competition and about RFPs and going out for vendors in terms of who would be providing these services. But looking at your estimates and what services would be provided directly by the vendor, what the discussion would be around those items that you have identified that would be provided directly by the vendor. Many of these items are actually going to be provided by the virtual charter school, and they'll be within their budget. So we're not talking about the total amount of funding. We're talking about basically, in some instances, the platform, the curriculum development, the management of the platform. Those are the parties we're asking for competition in. So I just wanted to put those things on record, that we're not talking about the overall cost, because some of those overall costs are not going to be being paid to the vendor in the first place. So, but I do very much appreciate the concern about competition. And
and just to follow up on the profit thing, and I'm not going to put words in anybody's mouth, but I was at a conference last week, and one of the presentations was made by a private school vendor, I think out of Sweden, and when he was asked in a room full of people from around the country, he very openly stated that they were working on a profit margin of 5.6%. So when asked, you know, he was very open about what, and so that's why I ask if Worka or K-12 or Insight or anybody's been asked. I don't know if they would answer or not, but I know I have heard private for-profit vendors in the past week state on the record a figure.
Well, thank you very much for coming. I think this certainly has inspired a lot of questions. I agree with Senator Devlin's assessment that it is further reinforcement that these are not easy questions to resolve, and there's a lot of data that's needed. I also wanted to express my delight that in Oregon there's a group that's called the Off the Record Group, mm-hmm. and how fun it is to see the minutes from the Off the Record group.
Remember, it's not a public school.
But it feels better if it's called Off the Record. If you'll note on our agenda, the next item was discussion of charter school law generally and virtual schools. The task force will have this discussion if time permits. Time does not permit, so we will need to return to that discussion at a different point in time. Co-Chair Devlin, do you want to give kind of an overview, going back to those other questions you had started talking about, coming back with a structure for the further discussion on our remaining areas of agreement to move forward for February?
I think what I'd like to do is do that, but I'm stating this from the standpoint of what I'm hearing, not the standpoint from that I believe you've all agreed to this. So I want to put that on the record first of all. So I'm not saying you've had that discussion. I'm just saying what I'm hearing. And maybe it'd be good to get some comments back on that. The issue number four, which is the issue about recommended level of funding. My best bet here is what we end up is that we're going to, understanding the department has limited resources and other parties have limited resources. The best probably direction we'd go here would be, in my mind, is that we would ask the department to do further study and to report to the 2011 session. Not necessarily to ask them to take any specific action or make any specific recommendation, but just basically to report back what they found from some additional study. 8 and 11 are the two issues about governance. I think we should ask them basically, in a sense, with some perimeters, with some guidance from this group, what they
feel should be recommended to the legislature as a government structure for virtual charter school, virtual schools. But that would be a recommendation to the legislature. This is just me. That would be, because I think they surprised us a little bit, not that we would agree with that recommendation, but we'd seen a draft report on the board's work, and then when they presented to it, for the first time, they presented a possible structure that they were thinking about putting forward. But I do think it would be good for them to put a recommendation before the legislature. From all the testimony I've heard, and I don't think this has to be in any sense threatening to both brick-and-mortar charter schools or virtual charter schools, I think they should come back to us in 2011 with a recommendation and with the bill to split the statute so that there is a statute. If they're going to keep it virtual charter schools, there is a statute for virtual charter schools and there is a statute for brick-and-mortar schools. That does not mean that I believe we should open up the whole discussion about what the laws are for charter schools, because that would be a very long discussion. But I think it's causing a significant amount of confusion, both for in the legislature, but actually for the community that's working with charter schools and virtual schools, trying to combine them into the same statute and having some unintended consequences in both areas. I think we should ask the department and the board just to look at the issue of how we're dealing with special needs children, because I think that's probably one of the most complex issues that we could deal with, and I think they should be reporting back to the respective education committees on that. I mean, it's an issue that most of the people on this committee know far more than I know about. I know Representative Gelser spends weeks on this issue in a month. Then there was a sort of a, not a minor issue, I wouldn't call it that, but some of the issues that came out of the light testimony here, the issue about part-time, whether it should be required or not, I think we need a recommendation on that, but I think there's dozens of different ways for the funding, and that's, but there should be a recommendation back from the Board of Education. The chart of accounts, perhaps we could address by 2010. I mean, so that there's just some common reporting in terms of numbers. That's a relatively easy thing. I mean, it has to be worked out with, obviously, the school districts that are the sponsoring school districts. It has to be worked out with the vendors. But just so that you can look at apples to apples and oranges to oranges, I think that's where I am. That's not necessarily where the group is, but that's what I've heard in the discussion.
So that
plus all of our other discussion on the other items that we already discussed that are in the draft, and the corrections that need to be made there.
Exactly. Right, and I believe that the panel mentioned, and we'll all be receiving soon copies of Susan Waddell's report as well. That will be.
I'm happy to forward those along as they're provided. Absolutely.
That would be fantastic. So look for those in your email box. And when is our next meeting?
November 17th.
Now, if we are correct in terms of the number of meetings that we have left,
November 19th before everyone panics.
Do you know the time?
We'll do it in the morning. I'm sorry. It'll be in the morning.
Yeah, it's actually a legislative day, so we are limited. In terms of access.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Dana or Chair, I have November 17th.
I think that's right.
Is there a change?
No, it is the 17th.
I have the
17th
on my schedule as well.
And if the co-chair Devlin mentioned earlier that the co-chairs believe we may have two meetings left, legislative leadership believes we may have only one meeting left, should the co-chairs be correct, would our next meeting be before or after the 17th?
Well, our next meeting would be the 17th, but I think we will need a final meeting after
that. Would be after that.
And we
after
will be
date.
Making a case to, when I say leadership, it's the President of the Senate and Speaker of the House, that we need an additional meeting to complete our, at least to complete our assignment.
All Right. Thank you all very much. And again, if you have comments on, I know there are a lot of stakeholders in the room, the faster you can get that information to us, the most helpful it will be since we're on a rapid timeline. Thank you all very much. Senator Bonamici.
I just want to ask Dana, I also had November 2nd on my calendar. Is that longer?
I think so. We were looking for an additional date and we came upon this one.
No, November 6th.
And that seemed to... Right. The online task force is adjourned.
Yeah, it is.